Hello everyone. It is great to have you back for episode 6 of our PolicyCorner.org podcast series. This episode is out later than usual due to the holidays, and also the sound quality might not be as outstanding as usual since we had to record this one via Skype. You should bear with us though, because today I am joined by Sarah Bressan and we will discuss her fascinating piece entitled A New Global Peace Paradigm, which discusses the emerging confrontation between national self-interest and multilateralism at the United Nations.
So, of course, multilateralism did not work out perfectly well, but the danger now is to take past failures as an evidence for we need to go back to national self-interest.
My name is Felix Hoffmann. I am moderating and producing this podcast for PolicyCorner.org, our website where we publish policy-oriented articles by young scholars and students. Go check it out. You can become a part of this great project, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and of course, tell your friends. Today with me is Sarah. She's about to finish her master's degree in international security and political science at Sciences Po and Freie Universität Berlin. She joins me to discuss a truly fascinating topic, namely the rising tensions in the United Nations between those favoring multilateralism as advocated by the United States after the end of the Cold War, and those focused on narrowly defined national self-interest, enshrined in Donald Trump's mantra of America first. Welcome, Sarah. So glad you could make it.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Okay, so cool that this works via Skype, and we'll start right off with our first question, because in your article you talk about the different paradigms that have shaped foreign and security policy since World War II. But in order to understand what this conflict of paradigms between multilateralism and national self-interest means, let's start off with the basics. What is a paradigm?
So a paradigm is basically a framework that contains the commonly accepted views about a certain subject or the conventions about how people are supposed to behave or what works. So what generally most people believe in works. And that is also generally accepted by a lot of people, like a large part of society. And it's mostly a simplified version. So it's a model or a pattern of how things work together. And in that sense, multilateralism can be seen as a paradigm because it was mostly accepted by many states after the Second World War, and it says, okay, different states should collaborate, and that's the model how we can move forward.
All right. So in your article, you argue that the international community right now faces a choice between two paradigms, which are A, multilateralism, and B, national self-interest. What makes you think that this is a choice that the international community is facing right now?
So this issue about a main dividing line, I think, has been around in the public debate for a while, where, for example, during the Cold War, we had communism on the one side and then liberalism on the other side. And then for a while, journalists and also intellectuals have been talking about that now it's more about open versus closed societies. So we have a different dividing line, and that actually, if you translate from one society, the open versus closed, to the international community, it would be multilateralism versus nationalism. And I think it is quite obvious, as I also argue in the article, when you follow debates on the international level at the United Nations, for example, that you have advocates for both sides, and these are the two, you know, broadly speaking, paradigms that now where there's a big question about where are we moving.
All right, interesting. So multilateralism certainly seems to be an important paradigm or something that has shaped foreign policy. So I'm wondering where is it that this paradigm of multilateralism actually came from in the first place?
Yeah, so I think historically it was clear after nation states were established that the states acted in their own interests and on their own behalf. But then I think it was around the beginning of the 1990s when this term global governance came up. So governance of the many, as opposed to governance by just one state against another state. And so multilateralism means that you don't act unilaterally, but as a state, you first talk to other states, you try to integrate your interests, and you try to discuss and work out a good solution for everybody.
So would you say that these are the defining features of multilateralism? Is that what multilateralism is, basically cooperation between states?
Yeah, certainly cooperation, and then also reciprocity, this idea of that you cannot just act unilaterally and it has no consequence. Because, I mean, after Second World War, there was the United Nations, states came together and they recognized that their behavior has implications on other states as well. And there is always a give and take, so to speak. So multilateralism would require states to recognize that. And then commit to, for example, a system of dispute settlement if they're confronting interests that don't seem to work out together. And then also try to enforce this type of behavior, this type of cooperation, onto other states.
All right, interesting. So probably the most important international organization there is, the United Nations. For them, obviously, such a paradigm is a very important thing because it's basically the rules of how you interact. So what do you think does this paradigm of multilateralism mean for the United Nations as an organization?
Yeah, so for the United Nations, I would say it is the fundamental basis of its existence, because you can only find an international organization based on cooperation and also this this mantra of unity and diversity when the individual entities actually commit to working together, because otherwise you would not reach any solutions, and there is kind of no point in meeting, you know, in a big room with all states together and talking about issues, and eventually everybody just acts on their own behalf. And so the United Nations is also, I mean, one sign that multilateralism has been the defining paradigm since Second World War during the last decades, because it was established exactly on this belief.
All right, wow. So if you're saying that multilateralism is the most fundamental aspect of cooperation inside the United Nations, I'm wondering, what would a United Nations look like if states followed the other paradigm, namely only follow their national self-interest?
Yeah, so, I mean, to be fair, you would have to say that, of course, also the United Nations example of a 100% multilateral, only based on cooperation and reciprocity. Because, for example, we have the UN Security Council, where you still have veto powers by five member states who can use their own interests to significantly influence global policy, also by the organization. And I'm, of course, not saying that the United Nations was perfect as an institution as it was or as it is today. But I mean, we can see that already this kind of shift towards more national self-interest, also with the United States, what I mentioned in the article, has an impact on the UN. For example, last week, the US ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, she announced this, I think 280 million budget cut for the next biannual UN budget. And so in a world where states believe in their national self-interest, of course, it might not make sense to pay a lot of money to an international organization. So we can already see that when states start prioritizing their own interests, that has an impact on the UN, and it might not be able to do what it does or what it has done during the last decades, like multilateral peace missions, dispute settlements, and also aid missions and all of these things.
All right. So, go ahead.
We can also see that with, for example, the U.S. decision to recognize Jerusalem as the Israeli capital, that, for example, also touches upon many different other issues, but it has also been criticized for missing the bigger picture, for actually being essentially a decision on behalf of one state or, like, one state's opinion that has a really big impact on the conflict and on a region. This has also been criticized for, okay, if you would believe in multilateralism and conflict dispute settlement by many states, you would not just make a declaration like that, but you would first talk to different parties and try to reach a solution more successively.
All right, so you already mentioned two important steps that the United States recently took in the framework of the United Nations. So I'm wondering, if the United States temporarily drops out as a patron for multilateralism, which this country has been for quite some time, who do you think will profit from the resulting gap in global governance?
The world at large, I think, does not, it's hard to say, because it depends, of course, on the way other central actors will react. If you ask for one patron for multilateralism as the U.S. dropping out, then you have other states like, for example, France with Emmanuel Macron, as I also mentioned in the article, who is a strong advocate of multilateralism and keeps emphasizing and trying to rally other states around this principle. And then, of course, also the EU as a whole might take advantage of this gap and, for example, be a more active actor in conflict resolution and dispute settlement and mediation processes. But then again, we know that the EU is also rather divided on some crucial issues, which is also open versus closed, multilateral versus self-interest. In the end, those who have always doubted that multilateralism works, they might also benefit from the U.S. stepping down, not because they fill the gap, but because they can argue that ultimately they were proven right, that multilateralism does not work.
Okay, so I think what we have seen in the last couple of years probably is that countries such as Russia and China certainly benefited from less American involvement in international policy. Do you think that, I think you already mentioned it, do you think that American restraint could also give a fresh impetus to a stronger European foreign policy and stronger European involvement in world affairs? Do you think there's a good chance that this will happen?
It depends on internal issues that the EU arguably has nowadays, I think, which we also have an article about on the Policy Corner about populism in Europe and how that plays out. But Russia and China have always upheld the principles of sovereignty and non-interference above all. And that, of course, also is connected to multilateralism or self-interest, because if you believe in multilateralism, you give certain autonomies, not maybe autonomies, but powers to an international organization to investigate things, to make rules for everybody. And the EU has been quite a good example of that because, despite the issues they have internally and also with, for example, Britain leaving, they have done a good job in making rules that everybody commits to. The border regime and migration might have been an exception. So the EU can serve as an example and also as to show the world that multilateralism eventually works because it's a successful model.
Okay, but I think just the fact that we have a very serious conversation right now inside the United Nations about these two seemingly conflicting paradigms shows us that multilateralism, of course, also had or has its pitfalls. Could you give us an idea of what the impact of this abstract notion of multilateralism was on the ground, and maybe also like what the problems were?
So, first of all, it would be, of course, naive to say that states that commit to multilateralism don't act self-interested. I mean, many, many also experts still say that states fundamentally always act self-interested. It's just about how you work out the self-interest together with other states' self-interests, right? So the crucial point is whether you abide by principles like reciprocity and collaboration to integrate your best interest with those of all other states. And then when we look at what you just asked about how it plays out on the ground, then we have to acknowledge that also multilateralism was not the cure for everything. As I said, the UN as an organization is not perfect, is far from perfect. Security Council that is not able to make decisions on how, for example, to proceed about the Syrian conflict or the genocide in Rwanda and all these things. Back then, it didn't really help that we had a multilateral organization and that we had the UN. And then, of course, what I mentioned in the article, or what my central argument is, that this whole state building and then later stabilization policies, those were also policies in the area of peace building that argue that they were essentially multilateralist, because you had multilateral missions. For example, ISAF in Afghanistan was a multilateral mission. But still, the concrete policies that were done did not eventually benefit the countries, did not solve the conflict sustainably, and all of this. So, of course, multilateralism did not work out perfectly well, but the danger now is to take past failures as an evidence for we need to go back to national self-interest.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So do you think that the threat of a paradigm shift towards narrow national self-interest as sort of the defining feature of foreign policy, could this threat also become sort of a healing shock to the paradigm of multilateralism as we knew it during its prime? Could it help to solve certain key issues that multilateralism certainly has?
It definitely could, and that is also what I hope for, and also what I argue for in my article, that people essentially start to realize the great achievements the international community made after the Second World War, with the creation of the UN and other organizations, after learning important lessons about the devastating effects that national self-interest and like a questionable philosophical reasoning about why a nation should prevail over everybody else. These lessons that were learned and then also the achievements that were made, this would be, as you rightly say, the moment to realize that and to acknowledge that and then to argue and lead into a more multilateral future.
Okay, interesting. You mentioned earlier already the recent decision by the United States to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And sort of in response to that decision on December 21st, with a vote of 128-9, the UN General Assembly voted to rebuke this decision by the United States to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Do you think that these votes are the first signs of open battle between those paradigms inside of the United Nations?
So between the paradigms of multilateralism and national self-interest, in a way, I think the Jerusalem decision and the whole question about Israel and Palestine, of course, touches upon, as I said, a lot of other issues, and it has a long historical background. It is a very complex conflict, and it's even a conflict where it's, we have to say, hard to talk about, because identities of the different actors matter very much, even as a researcher, when you want to make a statement or make a public statement about things like that. It's always quite controversial. I have to say that when you look at who voted for and against the resolution and who abstained and things like that, you can already see that, for example, European countries that abstained were, for example, Poland and Hungary and Czech Republic. And, I mean, those are the states that essentially in the EU at the moment are known for being more on the national self-interest side. And then, as I mentioned earlier, Trump making the U.S. administration deciding to recognize Israel, Israel's capital, Jerusalem, is a sign of, okay, they just make a decision and then see what everybody else does later, you know? And so, yes, in a way, this is also what we can see there, and this is also how it plays out. Although I think it's also dangerous to now use this conflict about Israel and Palestine again, you know, for an international debate about paradigms and so on. Because what I think would be good for this particular conflict is if it was not more politicized than it already is. And the danger that we have now is that it gets even, again, more politicized.
That's an interesting point, and especially the point about the European countries that that abstained from voting, because opponents of the U.S. decision had hoped for a far stronger rebuttal. There was hope for 150 votes or even more in favor of the resolution calling on the United States to rescind its decision from December 6th. So do you think the 128 votes in favor, or only 128 votes in favor, are a sign that the paradigm of national self-interest embodied by U.S. President Trump will ultimately prevail also in Europe?
I wouldn't necessarily see it as the multilateral side losing, because, I mean, as I just said, the U.S. administration, they said, okay, we will carefully note who will vote against us or abstain. And it was kind of almost like a threat to the other states. Okay, we will see what you do, and it will have consequences. And then when you look at who actually voted against the resolution, which are essentially seven states, like four of them small island states, two Central Americans, and one African country, that, I mean, speaks for itself when you think, okay, the U.S. is issuing kind of a threat there, and then you only have seven states that seem to feel like, okay, then we have to vote against it. Of course, there is a number of states that abstain the vote, as I just said, but, for example, there are not many European states. There are no major international players, like, for example, if you would have France, the UK, or Germany. So I don't think it's a good example for national self-interest and also a success of the U.S. administration. To the contrary, actually.
All right. So let's maybe look into the future a little bit, because we talked about the conflict of paradigms between multilateralism and national self-interest. We also talked about the current muddle and chaos inside of the United Nations. We talked about the question of Jerusalem. Considering all of this, what do you think needs to be done to, you know, make multilateralism great again? What is it that we have to do to strengthen the idea of cooperation between states?
Yeah, make it great again. That's good. building on what I said in my article, I would hope that the issue of peace building and conflict prevention could serve as kind of a catalyst in this debate of self-interest or multilateralism. Because with ongoing conflicts in countries like Syria, Yemen, and the DRC, the international community, of course, needs to think of a way to react. And as I mentioned, the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has announced conflict prevention as one of his main priorities. And what I say in my article is that the recent General Assembly debates show that opposing views of how states should act when facing conflicts in regions of the world, that this, according to self-interest or together multilaterally, shows that there is a real impact of these abstract paradigms on the concrete policies that are implemented, and especially on the policy area of peace building. So I would hope that this question about how can we bring peace to conflict-ridden areas, how can we make societies sustainably peaceful, that there we have kind of a momentum for multilateralists to say, okay, this is how it works, because national self-interest and nationalism are actually what brought us the major conflicts in this world. Like, of course, first of all, two big world wars, but then also many other conflicts that were about identity and these things. So to make multilateralism great again, that certainly requires a number of states to strengthen their commitments to this principle, to this paradigm, and be a good example by showing its clear benefits. Like I mentioned, the EU, despite its current challenges, it has. And then there are just so many examples of why acting unilaterally and on a questionable nationalistic ideology are bad. I think it's straightforward. It's just important to show that the law of the strongest does not ultimately prevail.
All right. Fascinating talk. Thank you so much for joining me over Skype, Sarah. It was really fun. And I hope you enjoyed this episode of our PolicyCorner.org podcast series, even though it was via Skype and the audio might not be perfect. But if you did like it, please subscribe on iTunes. You can maybe leave us a rating there. And of course, tell as many of your friends about this project as possible. My guest today was Sarah Bressan, thank you so much for joining me. Please feel free to check out our website, policycon.org, where you can find Sarah's article and many more. And do not hesitate to get in touch if you want to join our team. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Felix Hoffmann, and that's it for today. More exciting stuff to come, so be back next month for our policycon.org podcast series. Goodbye.